Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And I'm here at the WNYC studios with the morning production team. So first, let me introduce you to my director, JC. Say hi, Jay.
Hi, Jay.
Okay. So, Jay, I need your help with telling this next story. I want to review some of the big moments over the last 15 years, and I just want you to keep us up to date on one statistic as we move along. Let us know the number of Facebook users worldwide.
You got it.
So, September 2008, there's a subprime mortgage crisis. It's shaking the foundations of the American economy. Lehman Brothers collapses, and Senator Barack Obama, the first Black nominee of a major party, pulls ahead in the presidential race.
Okay, so at this point, Facebook has 100 million users worldwide.
Okay, so let's skip forward. November 2011, a massive nor'easter hits the East Coast. It's leaving millions without power. The first skirmishes of what will become the Arab Spring begin, and 20 are killed in a Syrian uprising.
So now Facebook has 845 million users worldwide.
Okay, now it's January 2015. 12 journalists are murdered by masked gunmen who stormed the offices of Charlie Hebdo in Paris, and Boko Haram captures a major town in the Boma region of Nigeria.
So now we're up to 1.5 billion.
Come forward to January 2017, when reality TV star Donald Trump is inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States, despite never previously holding public office.
Up, up, up. 2.1 billion users worldwide.
And then December 2020, the world is shut down and the global coronavirus pandemic has claimed 14 million lives.
All the way up to 2.9 billion users worldwide.
And then Jay, Monday, October 4th, 2021 at noon Eastern.
Facebook has zero anything. Facebook is just down.
So once again, we've been in the billions, and then Monday we're at zero. Now, it might seem silly to describe the outage of a social media networking site as disastrous, but across the past 15 years, the exponential growth of Facebook has been relentless. Massive economic and political shifts have taken place domestically and internationally. The world has lost tens of millions to famine, war, disease, pandemic. New leaders and nations have emerged, and all along, Facebook has done just one thing: grow. So the Facebook, IG, WhatsApp outage was remarkable. And this six-hour mass outage was the longest period the world's billions of users have experienced a no-Facebook world since its worst downtime of nearly 24 hours back in 2019. But see, the timing of this 2021 downtime fueled suspicions and prompted conspiratorial theories. Although it was harder to spread these theories, what with Facebook being down and all. The day before the mass outage, Facebook made headlines when former employee turned whistleblower Frances Haugen went public with evidence that Facebook knowingly chose profits over public safety. Tuesday, the day after the world lived 6 hours without liking, sharing, or living anything, Congress heard Haugen's testimony.
I'm here today because I believe Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken our democracy. The company's leadership knows how to make Facebook and Instagram safer, but won't make the necessary changes because they have put their astronomical profits before people.
And elected representatives from both parties expressed outrage, frustration, and a willingness to respond with regulation.
This research is the very definition of a bombshell. Facebook and big tech are facing a big tobacco moment.
I think that it will be this Congress and this subcommittee that is going to lead the way to online privacy, data security, Section 230 reforms.
So just what can Congress do? After all, there are only 535 members of the House and Senate, each making about $175,000 a year. Meanwhile, Facebook has over 2
billion users worldwide.
And CEO Mark Zuckerberg, well, he makes more than $25 million a year. So can David regulate this digital Goliath? Here with more is Cecilia Kong. Cecilia is a national technology reporter for the New York Times and co-author of An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Cecilia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with the outage. Is there any reason to believe that it is at all connected to this week's whistleblowing in media and in Congress?
I mean, there's not evidence yet. Facebook has said this has to do with errors related to their servers that connect to the sites, the apps, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook Messenger. And we have to take them at their word at this point that it is an IT basic malfunction problem. But it was an extraordinary outage. The timing could not be worse. But there is no conclusive evidence that is linked to the whistleblower.
I was wondering about that idea that the timing couldn't be worse, because I'll say sort of in our production meeting with the Takeaway team, one of the first things that emerged on Monday was a conversation about, well, maybe, you know, what we need is like these individual boycotts, people to go off of Facebook. And it's almost like the next day Facebook, or later that day, Facebook closing down almost felt like, hey, guys, just so you know, this is what the world would feel like without us. Mm-hmm.
I definitely saw on social media, as well as talking to people in real life, that people felt sort of that it was a refreshing break in the US. I should say that in other countries where Facebook is so necessary, particularly WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook, actually all the apps for communication, that it really, the outage highlighted that Facebook is a utility in so many countries and for so many users around the world, because that is really their on-ramp onto the internet and their only way of communicating.
If it is, in fact, the utility, and a really odd one, or one that we don't quite have maybe another example of, right, this kind of global utility that is nonetheless potentially going to be regulated in the U.S., should Congress, in fact, be regulating something if it's a utility?
You know, I think that the evidence is mounting, and based on my own research with my colleague Shira Frankel for our book, as well as what the whistleblower Frances Haugen has revealed, is that change will not come from within. The company is led by one individual, and Mark Zuckerberg has set a culture that has prioritized growth and has prioritized engagement, getting people to come back more and more and more, and really aiming and designing all of the technology tools to get people to engage in a way that growth is prioritized. And the collateral damage or the consequences of that is that you do have very toxic and harmful content that tends to thrive on these apps. So it's a dangerous situation. The change is not coming from within, because internally, Mark Zuckerberg has said even last night that all of the criticism is misguided, the company is misunderstood, and they're really digging their heels in. So the only way to see change has to be external. And increasingly, you're hearing experts across the aisle and lawmakers across the aisle, I should say, saying that it has to be through regulation. And it has to be a regulation that really strikes at the heart of the business model that Facebook has.
All right, so let's pause for a moment and go back to Haugen a bit. Can you talk about what kind of research and documents she has?
Yes. Frances Haugen, who was a product manager on the Civic Integrity team, obtained tens of thousands of documents, and most of it has to do with research that was done internally that show that the company has known and has been worried about the flood of toxic misinformation and just toxic content that tends to be prioritized on the site. Specifically, there were documents related to Instagram and the harms that Instagram poses to teenagers, and research that shows that teenagers say simply they don't feel good about themselves after using Instagram. One in three teenagers surveyed said that they felt like their body image was worse from using Instagram. There is other research that shows that Facebook decided to prioritize very engaging or agitating content leading to the ahead of the January 6th riots. There is other research that showed that Facebook has systematically under-resourced international content moderation in countries where disinformation on Facebook has thrived, such as Ethiopia and Myanmar. It was a really wide array of different type of research with the same central theme and pattern that emerged over and over again, which is that Facebook has known for a long time that problems exist, very, very deep problems exist within the systems of the company, and that misinformation and harmful content tends to thrive, and that Facebook has many times ignored these warnings and has certainly not disclosed all the research that Frances Haugen brought to the public.
I'm wondering if in some ways that fact that Facebook knows that they did the research, that the research demonstrated these harms, and then did not either adjust their business model or even sort of inform the public so that the public could make new consumption choices. Is that what makes this, that kind of parallel that we heard about big tobacco, right? This idea that, well, no, they knew.
Yeah, Melissa, I think that's exactly right. I think that you can quibble with whether Facebook can be compared with tobacco and cigarettes. But what you can't quibble with, and what seems like a very clear parallel, is that Facebook has said one thing to the public, which is that its products are safe, and that the net effect of Facebook's role in the world is that it's positive, that it connects people and people feel good about it. And that's the message that they've held since the beginning of Facebook in 2004. But what it also shows is what we've seen through this whistleblower's leaks and through reporting by many reporters is that Facebook has systematically not disclosed that it internally has known so much more about the dangers that Facebook poses, and that the messaging points are only one very small piece of the story of Facebook, which is that Facebook is internally grappling with a lot of the dangers and harms that its platform produces.
So how is Facebook responding to these documents and to this whistleblowing? Are they claiming it's not true? Are they claiming that it is, that these are sort of one part of the documents, but we haven't seen the rest? What's their sort of defense?
Yeah, all of the above. First of all, they are trying to discredit Frances Haugen, the whistleblower, and saying that she's only worked there for 2 years and she did not have direct reports and does not have expertise in some of the areas that she commented on in the hearing yesterday in the Senate panel. And Mark Zuckerberg yesterday posted on his Facebook account an internal message to employees where he really dug his heels in and said, look, this is not a company that we recognize. The way that the media is portraying us is not a company that we know to be truly who we are. The research that Frances Haugen has made public is taken out of context, and it is illogical, he said, that we are trying to prioritize profits over safety. And he says that advertisers, which is the business, Facebook is in the business of advertising, advertisers don't want to put their brands and their ads next to hateful content. But I will note, Melissa, that thousands of brands have protested Facebook and have tried to get Facebook to solve its content problem. And they indeed do not want to have their brands up against this content. But what they also say, these advertisers say, is that Facebook is so dominant that even though they're so upset about the way that Facebook manages this content, they have no other choice but to advertise on Facebook because that's where all the eyeballs are.
So Cecilia, let's just dig in here a little bit. Explain maybe a little bit more about this unlawful monopolization sort of discourse.
Yeah, right now, the Federal Trade Commission is seeking to break up Facebook through a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court. And their central argument is that Facebook has become a social media monopoly, and it uses its monopoly power to quash rivals and to ultimately harm consumers. Facebook adamantly disagrees. And interestingly, Frances Haugen, the whistleblower, says she does not believe that antitrust is actually the right remedy, and that by breaking up Facebook, you'll be starving the individual pieces of Facebook, if it were to be broken up, from the resources it needs to fight this problem of misinformation and hate speech. So antitrust is one of many solutions that's being bandied about in Washington, and you are seeing real action with the federal government trying to fight in that way. But there are real questions as to whether, and I've come to believe in my own reporting, there's real questions as to whether Facebook and the business model, which is a business model basically built on attention and agitation, if that can be solved by breaking it up into pieces. And if breaking it up really just creates more of problematic Facebook-like companies. So it's a really interesting debate. And maybe the solution is that all of the above has to happen, antitrust action and regulation.
Say a little bit more. I'm fascinated about the challenge of trying to regulate something where the fundamental model is getting eyeballs through agitation, which it does seem will ultimately always lead to a kind of race to the bottom in terms of content.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge in doing that is that in Washington so far, regulators have looked at a lot of the symptoms of the problem, like data privacy abuses, the spread of vaccine misinformation, and tried to regulate those specific things, but they haven't gotten to the heart of and the core of the technology that enables those things to happen. So really the bad seed or the real sickness, which is the algorithms that amplify the most agitating content, which is often this harmful content. But yesterday, I heard something quite different. And that was at the hearing, I heard lawmakers discussing very substantively with Frances Haugen the idea of regulating the algorithmic amplification of this business model and regulating it by forcing more transparency. That could start with forcing the company to share information about how it decides to rank within its newsfeed and decides to amplify certain content through like the likes and the shares and the comments, and how that kind of system, the algorithms, allows toxic and harmful content to spread so rapidly. By making that available to researchers, then researchers can show how the problem of misinformation is spreading and that sunlight is the best sort of disinfectant could be one solution. That was, I think, a first start. I think Facebook will be very reluctant to try to reveal too much about how its newsfeed works, especially to the public. And they have actually shut down a lot of research. They do enable and they do have lots of partnerships with other researchers, hundreds, in fact, but very recently, Facebook cut off researchers at NYU who were studying the spread of political misinformation in the 2020 election.
Cecilia Kang is national technology reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Whenever you enter a term into a search engine, whether it's debt ceiling or recipes for chocolate chip cookies, you're likely to be flooded by results in a split second. Now, having so much content available at our fingertips can be thrilling. But what's less apparent is how much bias is baked into the algorithms that bring certain results to the top of our Google searches and suppress others. Dr. Sophia Noble is an associate professor at UCLA in the Departments of Gender Studies and African American Studies. And she's also the author of the best-selling book, Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. In her research, she's extensively detailed the negative impacts that come from rarely having women of color, particularly Black women, programming algorithms to popular search engines. And when I spoke with her, she began by explaining where we're most likely to see bias in the context of algorithms.
Well, of course, we're watching the news unfold around social media and the way in which social media algorithms are designed to foster the most engagement. And typically that means with the most titillating or egregious or inflammatory kinds of material. What that does is, of course, contribute directly to antisocial behavior, harm, depression, addiction, all kinds of concerns. In other spaces where I focus a lot of my work around Google and commercial search engines, you find that there can often be a tremendous amount of racial and gender bias. And this really was evident to me about 10 years ago when I first started looking at how girls of color in the United States were so profoundly misrepresented in a search engine. You could do searches on Black girls, Latina girls, Asian girls, and have the majority of the first page of results come back as pornography or hypersexualized content. And of course, that's an incredibly inappropriate matchup for girl children of color to be represented and misrepresented in these ways. But also, it tells us so much about how vulnerable communities and people are neglected and really not thought about in the design of these algorithms.
On the one hand, it is both an indication of a harm being done when that search material comes back. But is it, and I mean this really legitimate, is it an appropriate algorithm in terms of demonstrating how Black girls and brown girls are represented and thought of within the social system?
Well, there's no doubt that this kind of racist and sexist and kind of misogynistic representation, misrepresentation has been hanging over the lives of Black women and girls of color for centuries. These ideas predate the internet. One big difference, though, I think, is that when those kinds of artifacts circulated in Hollywood and in popular culture as kind of racist artifacts, we had much more ability to kind of comprehend the subjective nature of that. Like, we knew what it was when we saw it, and we could kind of understand the role it was playing in popular culture. When people engage with something like a search engine, they truly believe they are in a knowledge portal. They don't think they're in a large multinational advertising platform that really privileges the highest bidders, you know, who's willing to kind of optimize and pay Google the most. They think that this is credible.
Can you say more about large tech companies like Google, like Facebook, and the ways they make choices to allow or create algorithms that lead to this kind of harm and exploitation?
What I've seen over the last decade is that in response to both my critiques and other people's critiques, terrible news stories, public relations fiascos, Google will change and suppress and modify the results. It'll downrank the terrible things. So one thing that helps us understand is that the large tech companies are able to manage and they do respond to the public relations crises. We might remember the infamous photoshopped image of First Lady Michelle Obama that had a racist image of a monkey superimposed over her face. And when you did a search on her name, this image would come up first in Google Images. And of course, that elicited quite an outcry from the media and the White House. And Google downgraded that image so that that didn't come up to the top. So what we know from their business practices, and this includes Facebook and other social media companies, is that in the countries where they do business, when illegal content moves around their platforms and becomes visible, they take it down. They hire armies of content moderators to screen content. And of course, there have been amazing books written about content moderation. What we know is that these companies are not just feeding back to the public what the public is doing. That's probably one of the greatest misnomers, is that people think, well, we get these results because that's just what people are doing. What we know is, in fact, that some of the most egregious kinds of material, it has high engagement. It circulates. You know, racist and sexist ideas are big business in America. And it's one of the reasons why we come across those kinds of ideas. The problem here, again, is that many people in the public, when they're working in search engines, they really think that it's that there are some experts or gatekeepers or knowledge, you know, they think maybe there's librarians or people who are curating and making sure that the best, most truthful, credible information comes to the top, and nothing actually could be further from the truth when you're looking at certain types of social information.
It's so useful to hear you frame it this way. Like the danger of reality TV versus scripted is if we're watching a sitcom, we know that it is fiction, but we can watch reality TV and believe it to be true, right? Believe it to be a documentary of some kind. Not, I mean, documentaries are themselves edited, but we understand it to be just sort of a representation of what is rather than these profit-driven choices, right, made by these large companies.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, that's a great analogy, because in unscripted television and these kinds of reality TV scenarios, the most inflammatory, the most sexualized, right, the most kind of stereotypical and derogatory kinds of unscripted content also sell, you know, especially I think, you know, for Black people, many of us find that our lives are much more boring and ordinary and mundane and kind of regular than the way we see African-Americans represented in reality television. And part of that is because playing off of these kinds of tropes in our society, again, is incredibly lucrative. And people tune in to kind of watch the train wrecks of it. But of course, it also does the work of confirming for so many people who never engage with Black people that, you know, maybe this is an accurate portrayal. And those are the things I worry about in search engines, is people do believe that a lot of the things they encounter is accurate. Because when you look for banal, boring information, like where's the closest Starbucks, you're going to get accurate information. Mm-hmm. And that those kinds of accuracies on the mundane reinforce your trust in things that might be incredibly subjective.
All right. So I also love that you point out, one, that in the mundane, we do get accuracy, and that when there is pressure, we get change. So how might regulation and from where? FTC, Congress, but how could regulation from some source get us to more accuracy and to change?
First of all, that we are even able to have these conversations about regulation puts a smile on my face so many mornings, because I can remember a decade ago when we talked about regulation, people shuddered. They just couldn't imagine that the way in which that would be an encroachment upon the tech industry. But of course, you know, the tech industry is one of the most powerful and unregulated, for the most part, industries in the country, and it has so much control and effect in our lives. So yes, absolutely. The Federal Trade Commission, you know, was the focus in my book of kind of where the interventions could come from, because I think so many things we deal with on the kind of commercial internet that we all are on are matters of consumer safety and safety for the public. And I think we have to kind of think about what monopolies and antitrust approaches could do to diversify the field of play, so to speak, and to give the public more choices, but also more importantly, to give the consumers more protections. I think we need an office of digital in the kind of civil rights division of the Department of Justice. And I think victims need to be able to have recourse beyond just kind of pursuing civil claims. We don't have enough laws on the books yet to protect people. And I think of groups that I'm a part of, like the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, who've done the critical work of getting things like non-consensual pornography or revenge porn laws on the books, the majority of the states. That has come from relentless organizing, and that has made a huge difference in the lives of mostly women who have been trolled with revenge porn and who've lost their livelihoods or been in harm's way. So laws are important, regulations important. But I think there's another part that I always want to kind of surface, which is, we have defunded so many of the democratic public institutions and counterweights to this environment of tech company control in our lives. And so college is out of reach for so many people. It's not affordable. Our K-12 schools are crumbling and are being defunded. We don't have a robust public health and public media systems. When you have a sector that for the most part doesn't pay taxes and engages in corporate tax evasion to the nth degree, the loss of those resources not only weakens all of these other kinds of institutions that would strengthen our literacy and our resolve and our kind of democratic fabric, but it also, I think, really creates market conditions for when those institutions are weakened, for those companies to rush in with their tech solutions and to continue to kind of grift off of the public. And so those are some of the things that I think are really important to also have in the conversation.
Professor Sophia Noble is a professor at UCLA and author of Algorithms of Oppression. If you think that what you heard was brilliant, it is perhaps because Dr. Noble is also a newly minted MacArthur Fellow, colloquially understood as a genius. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Noble.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And what you're hearing is the unforgettable voice of Afro-Latina, Cubano, and salsera Celia Cruz. Canta tu rumba, canta tu son, tu guarani. Now, she recorded the anti-racist song Bemba Colora in 1966. That, along with her signature sound, made her a beloved champion of so many Afro-Latinas in the diaspora. With the exception of Cruz, how many other Afro-Latinos can you name? How many can your children name? This is why, in part, representation matters. It matters so that people feel seen, heard, known. Many Afro-Latinos are taking up the call to make sure the next generation sees representations of themselves in one of the first places they experience images and stories, children's books. So I spoke with
Zulma Arzu Brown, a proud Garifuna Afro-Latina woman, author of Bad Hair Does Not Exist, Pelo Malo No Existe.
And I asked Zulma to tell me more about the book, Pelo Malo No Existe.
Pelo Malo No Existe was illustrated by my best friend, another Garifuna woman, Afro-Latina from Honduras. Her name is Isidra Sabio. And together we were just wanted to change this horrible colloquial term that described the thick textured hair of many of our children, terms that we ourselves grew up hearing, which is pelo malo, which means bad hair. And we believe that it was an opportunity for us to start offsetting the messages about our communities that are too often seen in the media. So even from the illustrations to the simple education, such as alternate terms for hair, so that no adult or child ever has to use the term pelo malo. Phrases and words like short, long, straight, curly, they're very simple to take on and eliminate the term bad hair.
That language of pelo malo, of bad hair, but also of good hair, right? Because even if you say good hair, it always presumes pelo malo is the alternate. I feel like this is so central to the experience of little Black girls, whether we are Afro-Latina or whether we are Black girls hailing from the diaspora or little Black girls hailing from the U.S. South. Why is hair so critical?
You know what? Hair can tell a story of who we are, tells a beautiful story of where we come from and our ancestors, right? And part of the process of colonialism is to try and erase what lives in us and actually grows through our scalp. And you're absolutely right in saying that this book is not just for Latinos. It was literally written for the global Black diaspora, so we can remember how to respect one another and teach the world how to respect us as well. This book was also written for those that do not look like us, right? That are not Black in color or Nubian, to get to understand the beauty of the Black experience, the way we carry ourselves within our families, right? The way we give gifts to one another, the way grandma passes down a cupcake recipe to her granddaughter, all of this beauty is depicted in this book. And again, it's definitely about making sure that we are telling our stories from our perspectives and how we see each other and one another in hopes of the world giving themselves that opportunity to get to see us in the light that we have always been.
So tell me some of your story. Tell me about the intersections of Latin identity and Blackness where you live.
Yeah, well, you know, right now I am in the Bronx, but I wasn't always here. I was born in Honduras and raised in a small Garifuna village. And the Garifuna people represent about 5% of the people in Honduras. Our quote unquote motherland is actually St. Vincent and the Grenadines, wherein the Garifuna people were created. And we are a mixture of the Arawak Indians, the Carib that were in the land, and actually slaves that came to the island of St. Vincent, because St. Vincent was actually considered neutral territory between the French and the English. So the slaves, even from Africa and from Barbados, will come in so that they would be free, right? And the mixture of all of these people created a brand new breed of people, which is the Garifuna people. So let me fast forward years later on why I came to this country. My mom and dad actually ventured to this country before my brother and I did. And the reason why my mom came here, because in Honduras, we are still today dealing with the same discriminatory tactics, right, that we've dealt years ago. My mom came to this country because she was overlooked for a promotion because she was Black, Garifuna, and a woman. And her boss literally told her, "You have family in the United States. I advise you to move over there, because there you will get the promotions that you deserve based on your qualifications." So she came here, graduated college, and so did my father. My brother and I both came 6 years later, and we are also successful college graduates. But I promised myself that my children will never have to go through this. So my life's journey is to create tools of empowerment and have these conversations to make sure that my mom's story does not repeat itself. But what will repeat itself is that strength that our ancestor placed in us for survival, which is the reason why the Garifuna people still to this day speak our own language, because we were never enslaved. The slaves normally take on the language of the master, and we have our own language. And because I was born in Honduras, and many Garifunas are in Guatemala, Belize, and Nicaragua, we identify as Afro-Latinos, with the exception of our brothers and sisters in Belize, because it is the only English colonized country.
As you expand the knowledge, the understanding, the consciousness of folks to even understand the global nature of Blackness, why does that matter for kids to see that in the books that they read as small people?
It matters because I think that that's how we have survived through history, is telling our story and reminding our children how strong they are, right? How important their contribution to the now is. And in order for you to understand what that is, you must understand the family members, your ancestors that came before you, that have already made history, because they might be something inside of you. For example, if a child is hungry to be an entrepreneur, right, and have her own business, for like myself, right, who is an entrepreneur, I'm wondering where's that coming from. And that's when I found out that my grandmother had the first supermarket in our small town of Santa Fe, Colón. That's when I found out that my grandfather, you know, ran his own business as well. So there's a history of community. There's a history of entrepreneurship, and understanding where that came from, you realize that, wow, I can breathe. I am not different, right? Like, this has happened in my story before, and it helps take them to a whole nother level. When I wrote the book, Bad Hair Does Not Exist, Pelo Malo No Existe, I can literally mark the difference between my kids' grades in school, when they didn't know who they were and the power that lived inside of them, versus when I wrote the book and they were able to breathe and say, I can do this. And not only were they able to breathe, but they became leaders in the space of anti-bullying, right? They started educating the young vanilla Latinas, you know, where they would kind of like whip their hair to the back, and they would tell my daughter, oh, you see, Suleni, you can't do this with your hair. You can't whip it back like us. And Suleni goes, well, that's okay, because I pad, baby. I pad, and this is how we do it. So she started padding her curly afro, right?
Yes.
in ways of educating. So it's just such, so powerful. And she became, she got a scholarship to an incredible high school because she didn't have to worry about who she was. The teachers knew that she would concentrate on her education because this is not a lost child trying to find herself, which is why we have to continue to write our books now even more than ever when our history is literally being erased. So I'm calling for more authors, more storytellers, more humans like ourselves to write your story. Our kids need it, and it is important for not just our survival, but it is important because we have to thrive and we have to honor the sacrifices of our ancestors in the process.
Suma Arzu Brown, author of Pelo Malo No Existe, gracias. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Hermana, era un placer. Que Dios te bendiga.
I also spoke with Charles Esperanza.
I am the author-illustrator of Boogie Boogie Y'all.
And Yesenia Moises.
Author-illustrator of Stella Stellar Hair.
I asked Yesenia to tell me about her book and the story of Stella's Stellar Hair.
So Stella Stellar Hair is a story about a young Black girl who goes on an interplanetary journey across the solar system to get help with her hair from her 9 fabulous space aunties.
Afro-Latina futurism?
I guess you can say that. Yeah, I mean, that sounds pretty on the nose.
In a children's book?
Yes.
Give us just a little bit more on the plot. Who are these aunties and what is it that they are doing with Stella?
Stella is looking for a new hairstyle because it's the day of the big Star Little Gala, you know, a very cool interplanetary party that's happening to celebrate the solar system. And her mom tries to do something, but she doesn't like it. And so she wants to have something really special for this big day. And her mom suggests that she go to see her aunties across the solar system, and her aunts all live on the different planets. And each of the aunties have their own unique way of styling their hair that's actually based around the planet's atmospheres.
I asked Charles how his book, Boogie Boogie Y'all, was not only a celebration of his hometown, the Bronx, but also of the diaspora.
So Boogie Boogie Y'all is basically a love letter to the Bronx and graffiti art. Basically, it came from me just wanting to explore more of my hometown and the culture that, you know, has come from that. I'm a teacher, so a lot of my students didn't really understand where graffiti came from. One day I saw an amazing graffiti piece outside of a community center I teach, and I took a picture of it and brought it into class, and all the students showed it to the students, and they were just amazed by it. And I told them, you know, what do you think of it? They're like, this is great. Where'd you find this? Is this in a museum or something? And I'm like, no, it's right across the street from, you know, the community center. And so right then and there, I realized that they maybe didn't take in as much as they should about their community and the art that's around them. So that kind of spawned the idea for Boogie Boogie Y'all. And so Boogie Boogie Y'all is basically, you know, a book that just inspires all its readers, kids, adults, anyone, to just look at the art on the wall, take in everything around you and how great it is. And it's also a rap song, too. We have a great audiobook out right now as well to go along with the book that I definitely recommend people partner with.
Now, these two are doing the work to help the next generation of kids. But I wondered when they first saw representations of themselves in media.
That experience came from watching Spider-Verse, Into the Spider-Verse, the movie that came out, I believe, in 2018, in December. I remember going to theaters and seeing that movie, and it was the very first time that I'd seen someone who, similar to me, was Afro-Latino, but was able to speak Spanish in their home, and it was just a very natural kind of thing. I went to a panel at the Apple Store where Peter Ramsey, the co-director for it, was talking, and he had mentioned that for the movie, he'd made sure that in the times when Miles was speaking Spanish to his parents, that there were no subtitles, because he felt like subtitles were very othering. It made you feel like, oh, this is like a really different language. This isn't normal. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the very first time where I saw that being someone who has darker skin and speaks Spanish was very normal. And that was very comforting to me.
I gotta say, it bothered me that 2018 was the first time Yesenia felt represented in media. I asked Charles about the gap and his normality and joyfulness not being reflected back to him.
I first started pitching Boogie Boogie Y'all maybe end of 2015, early 2016. And at that point, there wasn't as much advocacy for, you know, Black and Brown stories to be celebrated as they are now. And I definitely can see the difference right now, and it's really great. And, you know, we're getting some amazing stories. It's going to take a lot more to see a lot more stories get out.
I asked both Charles and Yesenia if they didn't have direct representation as kids. Where did they find spaces where they saw themselves?
As a kid, I was obsessed with anime, and I loved the amazing colors that they used, and everything in anime was, it kind of felt like it could be related to cartoons in America, but at the same time, things were really, really different and off. And I'd be like, whoa, what is this? And I kind of related to that because a lot of the stuff that I liked was, you know, very weird. It wasn't Marvel Comics. It wasn't Batman, Superman. It was, you know, this kind of weird place. And I feel like I really related to that. Also coming up watching Nickelodeon, Hey Arnold, you know, it took place in a city, you know, and I felt like a lot of the things that the characters in Hey Arnold went through, I could relate to. And, you know, even though it was a white main character, there were a lot of diversity in that show at the time. And Nickelodeon in general, I feel like had a good amount of diversity in the 90s.
I did really enjoy the worlds that were brought to me by anime and how they told stories in which the characters grew over time, as opposed to the more episodic kind of stories that we see in American cartoons these days. Well, not these days, there's a little more flavor to them now than there was back when I was growing up. But I just found it very fascinating, but also really, I guess, enriching. It made me feel seen, to see characters that were going through things, and they had, you know, their own issues they were working through. They had adventures that they were going on with friends. And I really love the idea that, like, friendship is power. That's something that we don't really get a lot in back then, we didn't really get a lot in the American cartoons that we had here. Things like Dexter's Laboratory or Powerpuff Girls. Like, yeah, they'd go on adventures. Yeah, they, like, you know, have the flavor of the day monster where they beat up the bad guy. But we didn't really get to see them, you know, have internal dialogues about, well, you know, what am I feeling right now? And how do I want to go about tackling this problem that's before me? Things like that, I didn't really see very much of in American cartoons. And I really enjoyed that aspect. I really enjoyed the how just colorful their worlds were, how imaginative they could be. And I think that sort of thing made me feel a lot more seen than the worlds that I was seeing on, you know, Cartoon Network or Kids WB.
Charles Esperanza and Yesenia Moises, thank you both for joining us here at The Takeaway.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa.
That's the show, y'all. I hope you loved it, and I definitely hope you loved that Celia Cruz and that she got you going as much as she got me going. That beat, that voice, it is just life. Now, if you missed anything or you want to listen back, check out our podcast. You can find us wherever you get your audio or head on over to thetakeaway.org. And of course, call us with your show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or, of course, send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm still recording live from New York City. This is The Takeaway.